Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The slaughter of thousands of innocent people on 9/11 forever shattered a sense of safety within our own borders that Americans once took for granted. Since then, we've all dealt with heightened security measures in public places and learned not to assume our electronic communications will go unscrutinized by the NSA. But other than those who lost loved ones in the attacks and the subsequent war on terror, it's arguable that the Americans for whom things have changed the most are those who practice Islam or who come from places or have names that suggest they might. Mustafa Bayoumi is one of them. He's a college professor and a U.S. citizen. And as a Muslim American living in New York, he has both observed and experienced life within a culture that tends to view all Muslims with suspicion and assume any adherents to the faith are somehow susceptible to radicalization that might make them a threat to public safety. Mustafa Bayoumi teaches English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York. His new book is called This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Mustafa, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
You write that the global war on terror has produced a global war on terror culture. What do you mean by that?
I think there's a perception out there that we can equate Muslims with terrorism, and it means that all elements of Muslim American life disappear within that equation. And this culture exists not just within our TV screens or on the movie screens, but also within law enforcement and our political culture. It really pervades the culture of the United States right now.
Like just about everybody else in America, you were horrified and saddened by the 9/11 attacks. Did you realize immediately, though, that these would be a sort of dividing line in terms of your life in this country and the way that you were able to be accepted just for who you were or sort of viewed through a different lens for the rest of your days here?
You know, I think I did. I mean, I also have lived here since the Oklahoma City bombing as well. And when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, there was an immediate rush to judgment that was also caused by Muslims. And of course, that proved to be false. But the fallout from that was already quite bad. And I knew that even if this were the case, then it was going to just be really terrible for the community.
It's understandable, right, that people are afraid of terrorism. But can you give us some perspective, as you do in the book, on mass shootings carried out by non-Muslims as compared to attacks by Muslims in the wake of 9/11?
Oh, sure. I mean, in fact, in the United States, there's much, much more, violence that's emanating out of militia groups or right-wing extremist groups than there is from the Muslim American community. In fact, there are, in the past, if you take a couple of years ago as an example, I think just last year, there were more than twice as many high school shooting deaths than there were deaths caused by violence by Muslim Americans. The violence by Muslim Americans is really minuscule, actually. It's blown entirely out of proportion. We don't actually have a kind of proportionality of thinking about it.
You write about an AP report exposing the kind of surveillance conducted on Muslims in New York City after 9/11. What was involved in that program generally?
So this was a report. This was a series that the Associated Press produced starting in 2011 because they had gotten access to these secret documents coming out of the New York City Police Department that showed that the New York City Police Department had been cooperating with the Central Intelligence Agency to spy on every facet of Muslim American life here in the tri-state area, from everything from where Muslims went to get their haircut to where they ate dinner to where they prayed to travel agencies they visited to the sports teams that they participated in. Nothing to do with probable cause, mind you, but just every element of Muslim American life. And that really sent a tremor through the community. You know, why should our lives now be scrutinized to this degree when there's no criminal basis for that?
You got in touch with a former student of yours who was being tailed, like going to the jewelry store with his fiance to buy an engagement ring.
Yeah, I did. Yes. I talked to him. You know, he's a popular young religious leader here in Brooklyn. And the NYPD was convinced that maybe he was a threat. And so they were tailing him at every level and every moment. And he, in fact, you know, suspected it because I guess they weren't that successful in hiding their tracks. And at one point, he even says to me, you know, we knew we were being tailed, but what are you going to do? Call the police on the police?
Did that very expensive undertaking by the NYPD yield useful information?
Absolutely not. It yielded actually not a single indictment towards terrorism. But, you know, so not only was it enormously wasteful and expensive, but I also think that it's fundamentally damaging to the notion of our civil liberties in this country. You know, I mean, it seems to me that the whole idea of living in a free and open society is that we have the right to a private life and the government should be public about its actions. But what we're seeing is in fact, the reversal of that. The public is demanded to live, we have to live publicly for the police, whereas all of the actions of law enforcement have to now be hidden in private. It seems to me that that's really a dangerous equation that we're going through.
I realize I'm asking you to generalize here, but what would you say are the assumptions that non-Muslim Americans make about their Muslim neighbors if they don't know them personally?
Well, I think, you know, you see a lot of suspicion. You see, so there's suspicion that there's some sort of violence lurking either in the present or in the future. I think a lot of non-Muslims think Muslims are fundamentally misogynistic, that they're backwards, that they're uncivilized, that they're savage, that they're barbarians. These are the kinds of attitudes that have often attached to, people who are seen as other within any given society.
Yeah, you make a point that there are some parallels to laws that were used to deliberately exclude Chinese immigrants from coming to this country and how they've influenced the way we try to control immigration from majority Muslim countries.
Yeah, that's right, actually. Right about a year following the terrorist attacks of September 11th, the government passed this program that was called special registration, where they required all Muslim males over the age of 14, basically, who were living in the country as immigrants to register with the government. This had an enormous effect on the community. It's almost unknown within the larger American community, but within the Muslim community, it was very, very it was very difficult. And the legal authority for that goes all the way back to the Chinese exclusion laws of the late 19th century. So there's a connection here, I think, that we have to look at to how we look at our the people who are not like the rest of us and the majority of us in the society and what we're doing to incorporate them or to exclude them.
I wonder if you worry a lot about the extent to which Muslims living in this country start to absorb that suspicion and that, you know, fear that people seem to have of them. I have a friend, and she's not religious herself, but she told me once, my father's a Muslim. And then she said, but he's not one of those bad Muslims, like as if I would think that, and as if it was necessary to make that clear so that I would sort of understand that she was a good person.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, a whole lot, and especially with the younger generation who, you know, really are grappling with this without any history of living with their Muslim identity prior to this era. I think it's very troubling. And, I also hear all kinds of stories of people who, for example, will not talk about their faith openly in their workplace because they're afraid that it could have negative impacts for them on their workplace. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that I think are very damaging to our civil society in the United States.
How much did you find that people that you knew just socially and at work and things like that knew about Islam before 9/11?
I think almost nothing. And frankly, I think that even post 9/11, the amount of actual knowledge that people have about Islam is really quite frighteningly low.
Yeah, you guessed my second follow-up question there. but it does seem like lots of, you know, and you make the point that, you know, law enforcement agencies have had sort of a crash course that, leaves out a lot of nuance and has trafficked in some cases on stereotypes.
Absolutely. Law enforcement essentially sees the Muslim community only through the lens of national security. And so they don't understand what the rhythms and the daily life of Muslim Americans really is all about, or really what their belief practices are, or what their values are. They only see them through the lens of a threat. And we see this with other communities, too. I think law enforcement nationally tends to see African Americans in a specific way or Latinos in a specific way and Muslim Americans in a specific way. I think that's really a problem. The other notion of this, too, is that there's an idea that Islam in the United States or Muslims in the United States became noteworthy only since September 11th, 2001. But in fact, that also leaves out an enormously long and complex history. Islam has been in the United States since the days of slavery. So Islam actually exists in the United States prior to the United States being a nation.
Tell us a little bit about that history, because you have some fascinating stuff in the book that I think many Americans were not taught in history class.
Sure. You know, many of the slaves, many of the people who were enslaved and came to the United States in chains came from West Africa. And West Africa has a long, long history with Islam. And many of them, in fact, were devout, and they could read and write in Arabic. It's a totally fascinating history. When they were, there was one of the premises of slavery itself was that people who were of African descent could not have the capacity to be able to read and write, for example. And there were laws eventually that were passed in some states that said that you couldn't even teach literacy to slaves. Whereas when you saw some of these Africans who were actually writing and reading and writing in Arabic, it was very common in the days of slavery that those slaves would then be transformed from being Africans to being Arabs. And this is a kind of, you know, this is an element of our history that is very dear to Muslim Americans and, again, almost unknown to the larger public.
And there are links that filter into things like culture and music and some, you know, sort of cultural exchanges between the what we now consider the Muslim American community and the African American community.
Indeed. In fact, the Muslim American community is about a third African American, quite likely. So African Americans are the largest group within the Muslim American community, according to several surveys. And there's a long history for that, too. And as you say, culturally, it's also been a very rich collaboration, you could say. Even such things as the blues, blues music goes all the way back to chanting of the Quran back in West Africa. There's a certain sound that you can hear channeled through the nasal passages that sounds in the ways in which West Africans chant the Quran that comes very clearly in blues music as well. Mm. So I think if we think about Muslim Americans only through the lens of national security, we're in fact limiting our access to our own American culture as well.
What is Orientalism, and how does the version practice today compare with what existed in the past?
Sure. So when I was a graduate student, I studied with Edward Said, who was a very well-known Palestinian-American professor, and he had written a book back in the late 70s called Orientalism. And Orientalism, prior to the writing of his book, referred to a specific kind of profession and a specific kind of attitude of looking at the Muslim world, essentially. And after the writing of his book, became clear that the way that these people were looking at, these experts were looking at the Muslim world, came from very much of a position of superiority, came from a very limited perspective on what Muslim life was like, basically defining everything that Muslims do at any time in the world as only related to how they're following their faith and not looking at how the other elements of their complex existence get involved with how they live their lives. And it was Orientalism, and the Orientalists themselves were key in, you know, the European conquest and creation of the colonies, the European colonies in many parts of the Muslim world. So it's a kind of synergy between knowledge and power that you found back in the 19th, especially in the 19th century and into the 20th century.
Why don't we make those assumptions if people of other faiths recognize that maybe ideally the goal is to always live in communion with whatever your faith teaches, but we often slip up or we have aspects of our lives that don't necessarily feel infused with religion?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a way in which there's a lot of things that get projected onto Muslim Americans, and that really, by projecting them onto Muslim Americans, then it simplifies their lives. You know, I think if we're talking about the ways in which, I do think that it's a real problem, and we have to think about the ways in which other people have complex attitudes, whereas Muslim Americans' relationships to their lives are always limited to the facts of their faith.
My guest is Mustafa Bayoumi. He's professor of English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, and author of a new book called This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org or send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with English professor Mustafa Bayoumi, author of a new book called This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. You can join the conversation, tell a story, ask a question at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Mustafa, I wonder what you've made of the stories about Ahmed Mohammed, the ninth grader here in Texas who was suspended from school for bringing in a clock that his teacher thought resembled a bomb, and specifically what you've made of how that story has been told in the media.
Yeah, I think the story illustrates the kind of panic that you see around anything involving Muslim Americans. I mean, how hard is it really to tell a clock from a bomb? And they certainly seem to not really be that afraid at that school, since they didn't evacuate the school even though they had arrested the young man, the young boy. He was only 14 years old. So I think, in his case, it turned out well in the end, of course. But, he got tweeted out by the president, and that illustrated a certain kind of leadership that we don't see from somebody, say, like Donald Trump, for example. So I think that it does illustrate, though, the levels of fear and panic that's really attached to Muslim Americans today.
What's also interesting is that we haven't heard of school attacks being carried out, as far as I know, by Muslim American students, and we've seen a number of them, unfortunately, by white students.
Yeah, precisely. You know, I think that there's a level of disproportionality that we have in the country towards the Muslim American threat. That's not to say that there's not terrorism. I certainly understand that terrorism exists out there, and I certainly understand that it's the job of law enforcement to look for those, to search them out, and when there's probable cause, to continue investigations. But I think it's a massive waste of resources, and it also has the effect of really alienating the Muslim community when you are targeting the whole community, and you're frankly quite unlikely to find what you're looking for.
I should make clear, by the way, that I'm aware that there are white Americans who are Muslims who practice Islam. I just want to make sure I made that distinction. Do you think that there's some obligation within the Muslim community? I know that a lot of, organizations have tried to sort of make sure they're out in the community and have opened the doors to their mosques and to community meetings. Is there anything else that you look around and think the community could be doing in order to sort of reassure the rest of America that they are just regular people trying to, get their kids to school and earn a living and have a good American life?
Well, I think that's everybody's responsibility. I think it is part of the responsibility of Muslim Americans, but it's also the responsibility of other Americans to recognize that fact. You know, national polling data tells us that only about 62%, so almost two-thirds of the American public, say that they've never even met a Muslim. So almost two-thirds of the American public admit to never having met a Muslim. And yet I would bet that they all have an opinion about Muslims. And so that opinion comes largely through the media. And I think that that's also something that makes the Muslim American community quite different than the rest of the country. It's only about 1%. We're only about 1% of the American population. And yet, everybody has an opinion about you. But those same surveys and other surveys also show that the people who do know a Muslim, their levels of hostility towards Muslims and Islam goes way down. Hmm. I mean, in some ways, it's really a no-brainer. It's like when you actually know people as people, then you find it a lot harder to other them, to make them into something that they're not, to make them into a threat, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, the more that we understand that we're all working together in this country to make a better country, the better advantages for all of us.
You have a tongue-in-cheek list in the book called 11 Rules for Writing Muslim Characters by Abdul. We'll get to that list in a minute. We should first tackle the fact that, unbeknownst to a large number of apparently novelists and screenwriters, Abdul is not really a name in Arabic.
Yes, that's right. Abdul is half of a name. Abd means servant of. And Abdullah, for example, would be servant of Allah or servant of God. And then God in the Muslim tradition has 99 names, so that name attaches to the name of God. But Abdul only means servant of one of those attributes. So it's actually not a full name. It's like saying, Mick, I suppose, for a whole name that comes from the Celtic tradition.
Hmm. All right, on to the rules. These are essentially like 11 shortcut stereotypes that you see showing up over and over and over in media depictions of Muslim life.
Yeah. I discovered inadvertently a few years ago, or maybe just 18 months ago or so, that there was a kind of trashy detective novel that had been published by Simon & Schuster that has a Muslim terrorist character in the as one of the suspects in the detective novel. And his name happened to be Mustafa Beyoumi, which is my name. And so it was a very, very odd experience reading a book where you're looking at your own name as a kind of terrorist doppelganger for you. And so I wrote a little essay based on this experience where I actually end up meeting my terrorist doppelganger. And he tells me exactly what the rules of representing Muslims are in this list that you're describing.
Can you read a couple of your favorites for us? Do you have the book in front of you?
I do, if you give me one second.
Page 249.
Thank you. Yes, okay. For one thing, Muslim men with beards should never be shown smiling. let's see. Be sure you have at least one good Muslim character, preferably one good for each one bad. People will then say your film or book is balanced, when in fact, as you know, its function is more akin to an alibi. Mm. Besides, 50-50 are pretty good odds that half of all Muslims are terrorists.
These are funny, but they have to be maddening as well, because, I mean, so much entertainment that a lot of people go to see and just think, well, it's just a dumb popcorn movie. This is like a characterization of people that you know and care about and people you relate to.
I think it's enormously important especially for young Muslim Americans, when you see people on screens that you can identify with, then it really indicates that you are part of the society. When you see people on screens who are always and always, always the villainous characters, or just these very thinly described victim characters, then you feel as if you have no place within the larger society as well. And, I really do think that it's an effort that could be made on the part of the Muslim community and just on the media in general, coming out of Hollywood or television, that there should be more complex and greater representations of what Muslim American life really are about.
Hmm. Number 9 on that list is, when you have bad American Muslim characters, make sure to exaggerate their foreignness. Spicy cuisine and suicide vests are good tools for this.
Yeah.
You write about Homeland, which is the very popular series. Is it on HBO? Is that where it is with Claire Danes?
Yeah, it's
Showtime.
Showtime, think. Yes.
Okay. I mean, obviously, you've seen it. Do you have conflicted feelings about turning it on? Do you feel like you need to tune in to know what people are going to be thinking about you and your family next week?
Yes, indeed. I mean, for people, it's entertainment. For me, it's work. And sometimes it feels like work because, you just don't want to confront these kinds of representations over and over again. At a certain point, it can almost become comical. I mean, the thing about a show like Homeland is that I think it just repeats the idea that Muslims are some kind of potential threat over and over again, unless they work unless they work directly for the government.
Right.
There's very little space that's carved out for Muslim Americans to have a political opinion or to have any other kind of complex opinion in the United States. You either have to be seen as being fully in line with everything that the government does all the time, or you're outside of the pale. I mean, just recently we saw the Democratic former presidential candidate, General Wesley Clark, even invoking the idea of bringing internment camps back for so-called radicalized Americans. But he never said what radicalized Americans actually are. I don't know what radicalized Americans would be. How do you define that in order to put people in internment camps? That sounds to me like you're saying that Muslim Americans cannot have an opinion that would oppose the U.S. government's opinion on various issues. And that seems to me to be very anti-democratic.
I think we should talk about this idea of radicalization, because one of the perceptions in the broader American community is that, if you practice Islam and you are a faithful member of that community, that you are sort of at any moment, if something goes wrong, you can be turned into some kind of radical. Is this just laughable? Is it the kind of thing that people who are in these communities fail to understand, give us a sense of what this sounds like to you.
You know, It sounds like bad social science most of the time to me, that has all kinds of consequences attached to it. They have these, coming out of, especially out of law enforcement, these ideas of radicalization, these theories of radicalization often follow these conveyor belt theories, so that you have to look for these telltale signs, like suddenly, you know, somebody's growing a beard or starts to carry a Quran. But those are normal everyday practices, and so you know what it really does is it starts to criminalize every kind of normal everyday practice for Muslim Americans. How people actually get radicalized, you know, and is something that I don't really know. I mean, if you ask me, I would say that it's a terrible, terrible thing. But you know, war actually radicalizes people into violence, and I think that it's time that we come to recognize that, especially in our age right now, that war is begetting more war. It's not bringing peace. It's actually bringing us to more war. And we have to work towards ending these wars, ending these conflicts, scaling back the militarism that we see some often around us. And only then will we actually have a handle on limiting the kind of radicalization that we see.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Nicole in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a story. I grew up in Richardson, in an area that's really, I mean, I'm a white female, you know, was not the majority there. There's a lot of different people, and I knew a lot of Muslim girls at my school. And to be honest, I didn't know what Muslim nude was. I just knew that they wore hijabs on their head and, you know, they looked different. But, after 9/11, you know, I'd have girls telling stories about, like, you know, a man in the road just driving right up on her and, you know, not stopping their car when she was walking across the street. And it was just really sad because, you know, not to stereotype, but these girls were probably the nicest girls in my school. You know, they were sweet, respectful, and hardworking people. And it's just sad. I really agree with what you're saying about, you know, radicalization, that, you know, we hear about terror, and the response should not be to become terrorists ourselves and to attack innocent people who are good people.
Thanks for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Mustafa?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've seen all kinds of elevated attacks on Muslim Americans since the 9/11, and so often they're kind of ludicrous. I can give you a very recent example that happened here in New York City. There was a big mural that had been painted in one of the neighborhoods in New York City out of a human rights campaign because there was this woman who was an artist who's actually in an Iranian prison as a political prisoner. So there was a mural of her face to try to bring attention to her case. It's a face of a Muslim woman in hijab, and people objected just because they objected to having the face of a Muslim woman in their neighborhood. And to me, that's crazy. This is an attempt actually to bring a human rights situation to people's consciousness, and instead they're only objecting to the fact that there's a Muslim woman on the side of a building, to the point where they started shooting red paintballs at the mural. And so they're going to actually cover up the mural early from when it had been scheduled. And I think that's also just a tragic, very local, very recent example.
Here's a question via email from Denise, who says, I am a liberal, but I have reservations about accepting Muslims because of the way women are treated in many Muslim countries. Do Muslims in America accept women as equals or hold to older religious views? What can you tell us about that?
Well, Muslims in America actually have incredibly diverse views on all kinds of things, including theological issues. So once again, I think it's really difficult to say there's one thing about what Muslims do, and yet somehow people expect that there's a Muslim answer to everything. But, you know, in the same way that you have very conservative Christians or conservative Jewish communities within the country, you have conservative Muslim communities as well. And you also have very liberal Muslim communities at the same time. But on the whole, I would say that the Muslim American community, generally speaking, tends to be very socially conscious, and although socially conservative, tends to be more liberal than the Muslim community that you would find even in compared to Europe or the Middle East.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Kathy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I may be misinformed about this, so I'm wondering whether your guest would know. I have heard that, you know, bad Muslims, terrorist Muslims, have been planted here in the United States. Is this true?
Well, I don't have any insider knowledge to this, but I would tell you that it is not true. I think that it's really easy to ramp up people's fears by saying such things. I think that we've seen very, very little evidence of it in the, you know, in the decade plus since the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I think that there's a certain kind of political agenda that is advanced when people's fears like this are stoked. So I just think that, you know, we had the same kinds of ideas when we came to Japanese Americans in World War II or the Red Scares that have plagued this country at various times. And so I think we need to step back and look at some of the evidence rather than looking at what people's fears are.
We know that there are hundreds of thousands of refugees right now from Syria and Afghanistan and other places who need safe places to live around the world. A lot of them are going to Europe. Are you surprised at the small number that the United States has agreed to open its doors to?
I'm disappointed, I guess, more than surprised. I think that the there has been a kind of concerted policy effort to limit Muslim immigration into the United States. This is also something that most people don't know, but it's actually been well documented by the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, especially in the Southern California. They issued a report a few years ago about how there were all kinds of Muslims whose citizenships were being delayed or were not going through. And it seemed to be targeted directly for the Muslim communities abroad coming into the United States. So, you know, again, I feel like the United States has actually a responsibility, a duty to the Middle East, particularly considering the war in Iraq in 2003 has really inflamed that whole region. So I would like to see a more responsible immigration policy come out of that.
We're speaking this hour with English professor Mustafa Bayoumi. He teaches at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, and has a new book out called This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Mustafa Bayoumi, who is professor of English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, and author of This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mustafa, you became a U.S. citizen 4 years ago. And as you note, you could have applied years before that. Was there something about the way that you felt Muslims were perceived in America that caused you to wait, or kind of explain the timing for us?
Yes, I came from Canada. I was raised in Canada. I grew up in Canada. I came to the United States for graduate school, and then I landed a job at Brooklyn College, where I'm happily teaching there. So I have a green card. I had a green card for a long time. A green card gives you residency. It gives you the right to work. And then I decided at a certain point that, you know, my life actually is here. I could have applied for citizenship many years earlier, as you say. But I think it took me the time for knowing when my green card had to be renewed. I was thinking about, well, you know, should I renew my green card or should I actually get citizenship? And I did decide that, you know, my life is here. I want my interventions here, my intellectual interventions to be based here. I want to really be a part of the society. And so I decided that I would take up citizenship.
So everybody who does this, part of the process includes an interview. Can you tell us about yours?
Yeah, it was a little bit strange because, you know, the officer asked me, you know, the requisite questions. I was able to answer them. I was able to write a sentence in the English language. I was very nervous for some reason while I was doing this. And I was like, I'm an English professor. I should be able to do this easily. And then he started asking me, your name is Mustafa? He said, your name is Mustafa Muhammad Bayoumi, which is my name. And mm-hmm. I said, yes. And he said, do you want your name to be Mustafa Muhammad Bayoumi? And I said to him, pardon me? I didn't understand for a long time what he was saying. He said, do you want Muhammad to be in your name? And I didn't understand what he was asking me. And I thought that maybe he was indicating that it would be very opportune for me now to actually not have Muhammad as my name, since there's so much anti-Muslim sentiment within the country. As it turns out, you know, I think it could have been motivated by that, but it was also motivated by the fact that this is a great time if you want to change your name for anybody. This is the time to do it because it's easier. So it also illustrated for me the way that people in the United States have this long history of reinvention when they become citizens.
That's strange to think about. But of course, we even know, like, there are a lot of entertainers that were from, like, Middle East countries in, you know, the mid part of the 20th century that changed their names.
Sure. Danny Thomas, for example. Yeah. Danny Thomas was a very famous comedian, and he's of a Lebanese background. Yeah.
And was it one of those things that, like, people within the Lebanese American community were like, that's one of ours, but they just, everybody kept it on the down low? I mean, it's strange to think that that was a necessary thing.
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, people within the Arab American community can identify their, you know, people in their community in the same way that Canadians always identify Canadians. And as a Canadian, I can tell you that that's definitely true. It's almost like a law that you just passed when you cross the border of the country. You have to always say, oh, he's Canadian or she's Canadian when it's talking about celebrities.
Paul Schaefer and whoever else is.
Exactly.
Do you feel like there's a big difference in the way that Muslims are treated in Canada and the United States?
Less and less, you know. Actually, the government in Canada is really, on, especially for Canadian politics, quite right wing, and they've also been using Muslims as very much as a wedge issue in Canada at the same time, and that's even more pronounced in the province of Quebec. So, you know, the United States has a kind of larger, you know, influence on the world, and it certainly has, like, you know, it has a certain approach to law enforcement and surveillance that's larger than in Canada. But I would say that the cultural issues of difference are pretty much the same these days.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-933-5372. We have John on the line now in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just calling because I have a number of Muslim friends. I have, you know, interacted with Muslims all my life, really. And coincidentally, I'm an immigration attorney, but this is, you know, from before I was an attorney. And it seems to me that most of my friends who are Muslim are just ordinary, everyday people. Just they could be of any religion. Yet what you see portrayed largely in TV and movies and in the media is, you know, this characteristic or this kind of a stereotype. And I found that's not at all the way people actually are. Now, the reason I'm calling is because it seems to me that this is probably just a reflection, or at least in part a reflection of the fact that ordinary everyday people don't sell newspapers, or granted, I guess people aren't buying newspapers anyway, but you know what I mean. Ordinary everyday people don't sell, you know, the news. And it seems to me like this fits in with this trend that you see kind of the far left wing and far right wing kind of taking over in the social, kind of in social media and the media more generally. And that's just kind of my comment.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I completely agree with John. And I think that there's even evidence for that. There was a show that was on TLC maybe 4 or 5 years ago called All American Muslim. I don't know if you remember that. But it was a reality TV show that was following a small number of Muslims from the Dearborn, Detroit area. And actually, the show was a little bit boring because they were pretty much ordinary Americans. But the right wing got very exercised on the show because they said, how can you possibly show a show about Muslim Americans that doesn't show anything about terrorism and radicalization, as if that's the actual average element of Muslim American life, which is completely ludicrous.
Is it your observation that biases against Muslim Americans extend even to those who are not actively religious?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's not just my observation. If I can bring up a study or two, I can tell you. For example, there was an interesting study that was done by this group called the Discrimination Resource Center several years ago, based in California. They sent around 5,000 similarly qualified resumes, but the resumes were all fake. They weren't actually real resumes. They're not attached to real people. But what they had done is they had test marketed the names beforehand so that they were all ethnically identifiable. So they wanted to see if you had a better chance or a worse chance of getting a job depending on your name. And so you actually had the best chance, according to their study, you had the best chance of getting a job if your name was Heidi McKenzie. And you had the worst chance of getting a job if your name was Abdulaziz Mansour.
Hmm. But exactly the same qualifications.
Exactly the same qualifications. And there have been other studies that have replicated this, even more recent studies. Often these are just employment discrimination studies. They're not looking for Islamophobic bias, but in what they discover in the run of it is that Muslims now often are faring the worst in these arenas. And I think that's so important to underline, because we're not just talking about people's perceptions, we're not just talking about opinions, but we're actually talking about consequences for people's lives.
Have you had students think about changing their names?
Oh, I have. Yes, I have. Yeah.
What do you say to somebody? On the one hand, you want people to be proud of who they are and to live in a country that accepts them, but they don't currently live in a country that accepts them.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I try to offer them the kind of support that they would that I think would be helpful for them, so that they can come and talk to me and these sorts of things. But I understand that these are very personal decisions, and oftentimes people change their names strategically. So they'll, if they're with one group or if they're looking for the job market, they'll change their names. But when they go home, they'll revert back to their actual birth name and these sorts of things.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Kenneth is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi. I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for sharing what you did earlier. I'm an African-American. I had no idea that a lot of my ancestors were actually of Muslim or Islamic descent. So first of all, thank you for that. Second of all, I did have a question regarding something that Ben Carson had said during the presidential campaign, I believe maybe a few weeks ago, saying that in his personal opinion, a Muslim could not run for president. Do you think that because of the biased situation we're in America regarding those of Islamic descent or religious preference, could that actually be a possibility somewhere in the near future, a Muslim actually running for president? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I would think so. I think it should be there, because there should be no religious test for the presidency. In fact, I just wrote a small little piece that was talking about this in comparison to Catholics back in the 1920s. There was a lot of anti-Catholic bias in the United States, just over around 100 years ago. And in 1928, Alfred E. Smith was the New York governor, and he was running for the presidency on the Democratic ticket, and he was a known Catholic. And, and everybody was afraid of Albert E. Smith. And they told, especially somebody like Alabama Senator Thomas Heflin, who said that if Smith is running and wins, then he said, this is a quote, he said that this will be the crowning effort of the Roman Catholic hierarchy to gain control of the United States. Hmm. And now we have a Congress that's almost a third Catholic, and we have the Pope come, and he was visited within a very American pomp and circumstance. And so, it should be that we should see Catholicism as part of the American religious fabric, and we should see Islam as part of the American religious fabric as well.
What do you think it would take to get the larger American population to understand that there is a great deal of diversity in the Muslim American community, in the same way that, this visit by the Pope has highlighted how much diversity and sometimes discord there is within the American Catholic Church?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it seems to me that, what it really is we have to shift the narrative outside of the exclusively national security narrative when we're talking about Muslim Americans. We always and only go to talk to them on anniversary of 9/11, when there's a terrorist attack, when there's this or that, the terrible thing that's happened. But Muslim Americans are already here living and have lived here for a very long time. And, it's another example from the days of slavery, because the earlier caller was very, hadn't even known this history, there was a great book from by a historian called Peter Wood from many, many years ago about colonial South Carolina. And in this book, I remember reading it a long time ago, and he says in his book that Mustafa, my name, was a fairly common name in colonial South Carolina, because there were so many Africans from West Africa who were Muslim at that time. So we need to understand the history and the present of the diversity of the American Muslim community. And I think the best way to do that is to shift it away from a national security narrative.
Since you're an English professor, besides your book, what would you recommend that Americans who want to understand culture and history and context in sort of looking at their Muslim neighbors? Are there books that you would send people to?
Yeah. I mean, I think that people can easily access the wide and rich variety of Muslim experiences in the ways that they experience all other things. Like, there's really interesting art, literature, drama. Some of it's coming out of the contemporary United States, and of course, it has a long history all over the world. But there's The Moor's Account by Leila Lalami, which is an excellent book that was a Pulitzer Prize finalist book last year, for example. There's really a growing cultural scene within the Muslim American community. There are all kinds of Muslim American comedians out there making all kinds of great comedy. I think that we really this is a community that is vibrant and growing, and not only would your support nurture them, but I think actually the people who would be interested in these sorts of things will find that the work is actually excellent.
Obviously, you're a lifelong writer, but I wonder if putting together these essays, some of them were published elsewhere before they appeared in the book. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So I wonder, though, if pulling them together and selecting the works that you would put in this book helped you really crystallize kind of where you are in terms of perceiving yourself to be accepted or not accepted, treated with suspicion or welcomed, like in 2015.
Oh, I think it definitely has, yeah. You know, when the New York City Police Department spying program was revealed, several documents came out and they were reported on by various journalists, one of which said that there was a lecturer of Middle Eastern descent who they were spying on at Brooklyn College, where I teach.
So you thought, how many of those are there, right?
Yeah, exactly. I thought this was me. In fact, I wasn't the only one who thought so. The Associated Press called me and asked me if they thought it was me, and the New York Times called me and asked me if they thought it was me. And so I still don't think it was me. Why should they be spying on me? As I say in the book, the only radical organization I've ever belonged to is the Park Slope Food Co-op here in Brooklyn, New York. But, you know, I think that it's very common. I mean, I tend to lecture all over the country. I've had the luxury, the benefit from this book and the previous book to be able to talk to Americans all over the country. And I think that I can survey the landscape out there. And while there is significant hostility that you see, there's also a lot of honest desire to actually get to know what your Muslim neighbors, to get to actually understand what's going on. Because there is a sense, I think, by a lot of the country that there's just not enough information out there, and that there is some sort of ramped up threat. And I really appreciate that kind of desire coming from people that I encounter across the country.
Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College. His new book is called This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Mustafa, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.